This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Back in the 80s, many people's first image of an individual with autism came in the form of Raymond, played by Dustin Hoffman in the Oscar-winning film Rain Man.
A2, A2, A2.
It's a lot more than A22, thanks, Raymond.
246 total.
You change. How many toothpicks are you?
250.
Pretty close.
246.
There's four left in the box.
Today, the CDC estimates that about 1 in 68 children has been identified as falling somewhere along the autism spectrum, having autism spectrum disorder, or ASD. With more and more ASD diagnoses comes an aggressive push to find causes and possible cures. That's in some quarters. A parallel movement is developing that regards autism not as a pathology or disorder, but as neurological diversity, and calls for it to be recognized and respected as a social category. Steve Silberman has covered science and cultural affairs for Wired and other magazines for more than 20 years. His book, Neurotribes: The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity, has just been released in paperback. We spoke to him when it first came out. Now, how do you define neurodiversity?
Well, the most succinct, I would say, summation of it that I've heard, and in fact recently, is great minds don't always think alike. So for a long time, we've considered conditions like dyslexia, ADHD, and autism only as sort of checklists of deficits. But it turns out that every one of those conditions also conveys certain cognitive advantages. For instance, autistic people are able to focus for a long time on tasks that interest them. They often have very good recall of facts, and they're good at detecting flaws in visual patterns. So what neurodiversity says is that we should start looking at people's strengths as well as the things that challenge them and the things that they find difficult. And that can be in school, for instance. Every parent of an autistic child knows how difficult IEP meetings can be. And one of the things that is very rough for both parents and kids about IEP meetings is that it's usually just going over what the kid can't do. Well, every child also has distinctive strengths. And so what if we started adding noticing the child's strengths to IEP meetings so that lessons could be customized for what truly engages them and what helps them feel capable and helps engage their natural interests? So I would say that neurodiversity is a way of looking at these conditions that takes into account their strengths as well as the challenges that they present. And I think it's been a little bit overhyped to say that, oh, you know, things like autism are just cognitive variations. Well, obviously, autism is a disability, and all of these conditions are disabilities. But a disability is something that society can also make accommodations for.
Well, tell us a little bit about this kind of origins of the neurodiversity movement and what its goals are.
Well, the word neurodiversity was invented by an anthropology grad student in Australia named Judy Singer. And she came up with it in the course of some conversations with one of the first online discussion groups for autistic people in the late 90s. And what they were talking about was, you know, the diagnosis was basically not available to adults until the 80s and 90s. And once adults were able to get a diagnosis as being on the spectrum, I mean, the spectrum didn't even exist before the 80s, actually. But once adults started identifying themselves as autistic, they rejected the notion that every single one of their fascinations and interests and abilities were just signs of pathology. And so they wanted to find a way to basically talk about autism that was free of the medical psychopathological context. And so she coined the word neurodiversity in the spirit of phrases like black is beautiful or gay is good. And she wanted to build a bridge between autism and the disability rights community, because the notion that society can accommodate disability is nothing new for people who are blind or deaf or who use wheelchairs. But in autism, that was a very new idea, and in some ways it's still a new idea. So in a way, embedded in the idea of neurodiversity is the notion that society can help relieve some of the most disabling aspects of these conditions by making reasonable accommodations.
So this was in the 1990s. Who are the advocates of the neurodiversity movement today?
Well, I can think of several organizations that are doing excellent work. For instance, the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network has been working at the highest levels in formulation of public policy that will benefit all people on the spectrum. Like some people have heard the word neurodiversity. If they've heard it in an unflattering context, they think that it's only about, so-called shiny Aspies, quote-unquote high-functioning people with, Asperger's syndrome on the mild end of the spectrum. That is not true. Neurodiversity advocacy groups like the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, the Autism Women's Network, they're working for changes in society that will benefit everybody at every point on the spectrum. And so, for instance, ASAN, the group I just mentioned, has just recently persuaded the Department of Transportation to issue guidelines to commercial air carriers to make accommodations for travelers on the spectrum of all ages, both children and adults. Any parent of an autistic kid can tell you that, flying for the first time on a plane can be truly an ordeal. But with some help from the ground crew and some accommodations in the air, it can be a much less stressful experience. And so the accommodations that ASAN has just fought for and won will help all people on the spectrum.
But it sounds like all very positive work. So why, then, is there so much controversy behind the neurodiversity movement?
Well, I think a lot of it comes from misunderstanding of what it means. Parents are understandably afraid that, somehow talking about the positive aspects of autism will make light of the fact that their children are struggling every day even to tie their own shoes or to go to class, et cetera. Autism is a very, very challenging condition. Anyone who says that autism isn't a disability is not familiar with it, really, I would say. But the other reason why there's some sort of, trash talk about neurodiversity is because some people continue to insist that autism is a unique product of the modern era, whether they blame it on vaccines or GMOs or Wi-Fi or whatever. And by the way, all of those things have been blamed, obviously, for the increase in autism diagnoses. But one of the things that I tried to do in my book was to show why the diagnoses have increased so startlingly in the last 25 years or so. And it is startling. It's completely understandable to me why parents would be absolutely terrified when they see that curve, that upward, like the hockey stick curve in climate change, mm-hmm. When they see that curve, it's absolutely terrifying. But that's because they've had no explanation of the fact that what the word autism meant in 1970 is completely different from what it means now. And so in a sense, it's not even the same condition, although the same condition is included in, in 1970, is included in what we now call the autism spectrum. But there are a lot more people who can gain access to a diagnosis now, and that's what's reflected in that hockey stick graph.
Steve Silberman is with us. He's covered science and cultural affairs for more than 20 years. He's got a new book out called Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. You talked about aligning the neurodiversity movement with the Black is Beautiful movement or with gay pride. Does this mean that there's a sense of pride about being on the autism spectrum, that would mean that people thought it was unnecessary to look for a cure or causes, but instead work towards understanding and acceptance of this kind of diversity?
Well, here's the thing. We, as a country, the United States, have spent more than $1 billion in the last 10 years searching for either a cause or a cure for autism. Where are those things? In fact, the search in the human genome for candidate genes that may produce autism has been very fruitful. We've found more than 600 candidate genes, but we still don't know which of them causes autism. And in fact, each autistic person is genetically quite unique. So it's not like there's an autism gene that we're going to find. There are many, many different genes. What about the environmental risk factors? That list gets longer every day. And in fact, a science blogger named Emily Willingham, who herself has a kid on the spectrum, once wrote a blog post called "This Just In, Being Alive Linked to Autism." So, you know, we could invest, you know, we could throw another $1 billion, which it's like a full employment plan for, you know, autism geneticists and environmental toxicologists. Or we could say, what if some of that money went to directly supporting autistic people and their families? So, you know, the word cure gets brought up so much. Cure, we should be looking for a cure. We've been looking for a cure for schizophrenia for, you know, 50 years. Where is it? These are all very highly complex, primarily genetic conditions. And so they're not so easily unraveled. So we could pour more and more money into that effort. But if in the meantime, parents are desperately afraid to die because they don't know if they can leave their children alone in the world without help, then we're not really dealing with autism seriously as a society. We're just congratulating ourselves for investing in autism science.
I was speaking with my colleague earlier about your book and the concept of neurotribes. And we were sort of questioning whether this is the brain's evolution, you know, that when we first came into being, human beings needed to be social. We needed those networks in order to live and to survive and strengthen ourselves and give ourselves numbers. Now, we don't need those kind of basic survival skills so much, but maybe we need brains that can compute and remember facts. And I'm just wondering if there's any thought on your part that, well, maybe autism spectrum disorder is where our brains need to go.
Well, that is a fascinating thought. I mean, I don't really talk about it in the book much, although I will say that one of the people who brought that up to me actually was Lorna Wing, who is the cognitive psychologist who invented the concept of the autism spectrum. So you're not alone in that field of speculation. The one thing I will say is that I think the really profound thing about the idea of neurodiversity is that it says that some of the same places that the genius of humanity comes from are the same places that some of the most difficult challenges in daily life that humanity faces come from. So our strengths are sort of inextricably intertwined with our impairments as a species. And in fact, there was, you know, this kind of movement of people with Asperger's syndrome who claimed that they were the next stage in evolution. I think evolution just works by trying out lots of different possibilities. And autism has been with us for a very long time. One of the most dangerous myths is that autism just popped out of nowhere in the 1980s. And that's a myth that, you know, was spread by the anti-vaccine movement. And it's wrong. I mean, there were autistic people in institutions for decades before that, or kids and adults who were struggling to get by without a diagnosis, which I write about quite a lot.
Mm-hmm. So, you've been writing about autism for almost 15 years. So what has changed since you first began looking into the autism spectrum?
Well, one thing that's changed is that, you know, when I first started writing about autism, a lot of parents were very excited because they felt that we were on the verge of discovering the autism gene. And, you know, I just explained how, in fact, we've discovered, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of autism genes. So it turns out that, you know, making the breakthrough that's going to make autism a thing of the past, I think science has come to understand that that was hopeful in certain ways, but completely naive in others, and that autism is a very, very complex condition, and that, you know, while we work on trying to figure out what causes it, because, you know, there's no way we're not going to look into that. It's very interesting, and autism, you know, creates a lot of suffering for families, particularly when social support is lacking. Instead of just pursuing that, I think we should be helping those families to live happier, healthier lives.
Well, Steve Silberman, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here.
That was Steve Silberman, a science and public policy journalist. His book, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity, is now out in paperback. You'll find a link for more at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.